KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures presenting The Shape of Water, nominated for 7 Golden Globe Awards, including director Guillermo del Toro, actress Sally Hawkins, and Best Picture of the Year, awards eligible in all categories.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This weekend, we hope you'll find a good film to go see. So many that are out, including some of the big titles going into broader release and some that are brand new in your local movie theaters. I'm joined this week by critics Christy Lemire, a co-host of YouTube's What the Flick and critic for RogerEbert.com, and Wade Major with Cinegods.com. We begin with the horror film Insidious, The Last Key, directed by Adam Robitel. Lee Whannell is the screenwriter. Lynn Shea, Spencer Locke, star. Christy, what'd you think?
So this is a January horror movie, which not necessarily inspire a whole lot of confidence, but it is surprisingly good. It is the fourth film in the Insidious franchise, and also the fact that it's a fourth film would not necessarily inspire a lot of confidence. But the secret weapon here is Lynn Shea, who is a longtime character actress, known mostly for comedy prior to this, did several Farrelly Brothers films, most famously There's Something About Mary and Kingpin, and there's a rawness to her presence, which is really funny and really great. But here, the Insidious films allow her to show a dramatic side, and that is especially true here. So she plays this parapsychologist named Elise, and we see her from her earliest days in this film and how she dealt with her gift as a child and the abuse she endured as a child. As an adult now, she gets a call to come and clean a house of a demon. And the house happens to
They're
be the
very messy.
Yeah. They leave trash everywhere.
Yeah.
But the house happens to be the one that she grew up in. And so she has to go back and visit her.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures presenting The Shape of Water, nominated for 7 Golden Globe Awards, including director Guillermo del Toro, actress Sally Hawkins, and Best Picture of the Year, awards eligible in all categories.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This weekend, we hope you'll find a good film to go see. So many that are out, including some of the big titles going into broader release and some that are brand new in your local movie theaters. I'm joined this week by critics Christy Lemire, a co-host of YouTube's What the Flick and critic for RogerEbert.com, and Wade Major with Cinegods.com. We begin with the horror film Insidious, The Last Key, directed by Adam Robitel. Lee Whannell is the screenwriter. Lynn Shea, Spencer Locke, star. Christy, what'd you think?
So this is a January horror movie, which not necessarily inspire a whole lot of confidence, but it is surprisingly good. It is the fourth film in the Insidious franchise, and also the fact that it's a fourth film would not necessarily inspire a lot of confidence. But the secret weapon here is Lynn Shea, who is a longtime character actress, known mostly for comedy prior to this, did several Farrelly Brothers films, most famously There's Something About Mary and Kingpin, and there's a rawness to her presence, which is really funny and really great. But here, the Insidious films allow her to show a dramatic side, and that is especially true here. So she plays this parapsychologist named Elise, and we see her from her earliest days in this film and how she dealt with her gift as a child and the abuse she endured as a child. As an adult now, she gets a call to come and clean a house of a demon. And the house happens to
They're
be the
very messy.
Yeah. They leave trash everywhere.
Yeah.
But the house happens to be the one that she grew up in. And so she has to go back and visit her own childhood demons and her own history. And along the way, she has her two wacky sidekicks. Lee Whannell, who has written all these films, plays one of them. And it has a lot of, you know, jump scares, a lot of really creepy imagery. It is a PG-13 horror movie, for better and for worse. So if you want hardcore horror, that is not this. This relies more on atmospherics and sound effects and mood. And it's pretty good. It has a surprising level of emotional resonance that perhaps you don't see in A, horror movies at all, but B, horror movies this time of year. So it's a slightly higher caliber. Of the four, I like the third one best, but this is what I like to call the Rogue One of the series, because it catches you up to the beginning of the first one. So if you are an Insidious completist,
you got
to
see it.
You got to see how we get back to the beginning of the first one. So it's pretty good, surprisingly pretty good.
And you said Lee Whannell has written all four of them.
He's written all four of them. He directed the third one. He and James Wan, who created the Saw series, also created this. And this is a different director this time, but very much of a piece with the series. And if you like them, this is a solid entry into the franchise.
Insidious, The Last Key, rated PG-13 in wide release. The drama Blaine is written and directed by Quinn Shepard, who also stars in the film with Chris Messina and Nadia Alexander. Wade?
You know, this would normally be a somewhat artsy version of a routine high school drama. You've got the outcast girl who's got some mental problems that are not quite specified, and then she goes back to school, and you have the mean girls picking on her, and then there may be a relationship with this teacher played by Chris Messina, and all of these elements we've seen before, but they're done in a very, very artistic way here, which is even more impressive when you realize that Quinn Shepard, who plays the troubled girl, was 20 when she wrote and directed this as her first film. She's been acting since she was a teenager, but she workshopped the script based on a lot of her own experiences in high school at Sundance. And then, and frankly, we're going to touch on this later, when you realize that a 20-year-old who's never made a movie before can actually put a film together that is this competent, there's no excuse for anyone else to make a bad movie. There just isn't. There just isn't.
And we'll talk about a lot of those bad movies as the show goes on. Yeah, it's really assured and really confident. And yeah, Wade's right. They do touch on a lot of the kinds of characters that we see, the mean cheerleaders and the dopey guys and the teacher who's more interesting than he looks. And yet there's an artful way that it's shot. She not only stars in it and directed it and co-wrote it, she produced it and edited it.
Yeah, that's what's most important.
And it's a little languid, I would say, but not in a way that is in any way alienating. It's just, it adds to the sort of moodiness of the film in
general.
She
has a really good eye. And I really, really hope she keeps pushing the directing envelope and does bigger and better things, because she has a really, really good eye. And that's not something you can learn. That's just how you see the world and how the camera translates that.
Yeah. She cashed in her college fund to finish this movie. Her financing fell through.
Yeah.
And so she had to cash in every last bit of her college fund money and would take the bus to Montreal to go do post-production and work on the music. And she shot it at her high school in New Jersey. It's really, really impressive.
So this is her film school, essentially.
Yeah.
And this is set in a suburban high school. Later in the program, I'm going to find out from both of you your favorite movie set in high school. There are some great ones over the years. The Breakfast Club is celebrating its big anniversary with a new Blu-ray release. We're going to talk about your favorites. That's later this hour on Film Week. Right now, we're talking about Blame, written and directed and starring Quinn Shepard. It's unrated, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. The Strange Ones, a dramatic a thriller written and directed by Christopher Ratcliffe and Lauren Volkstein. It stars Alex Pettifer and James Friedson Jackson. Christy, what'd you think?
This is also a very moody, arty, kind of understated film, almost to a fault perhaps, ultimately, but it's about a guy in his 20s and a teenager. And they are brothers, we think. We think it's an older brother and a younger brother on a road trip, on a camping trip. But there's something slightly off from the very, very beginning in terms of their interactions with each other, in terms of their interactions with other people. They are in upstate New York. The way the narrative is structured, we see some flashbacks from the perspective of the teenager. And you know something really traumatic has happened, but we see it in wisps and pieces, so we don't know what it is for a long time. And as the story goes on, it becomes clear what the relationship is and what the thing is that happened that they're running from. And it's really well acted and very, very beautifully shot in a kind of understated, again, moody, understated way. It's a little slow. It's a little quiet. So it might be kind of tough for a lot of viewers to latch onto it emotionally. But I never knew where it was going, and I liked it.
I mostly agree with that. Christopher Radcliffe and Lauren Wolkstein, who wrote and directed it, they made a short in 2011 that this is based on. And this then they took a number of years to expand that into a film and then premiered this at South by Southwest. And it's very much a South by Southwest kind of film. It's got that sun, you know, South by Southwest is sort of Sundance-y, but sometimes a little bit more raw, a little bit more out on the fringes. There are no name actors in this, yet everyone is really, really good, especially the two brothers. They're both excellent, absolutely outstanding. So there's a lot of talent to be discovered here. I did kind of feel like I've seen this before. It did feel a little bit like a short overinflated into a feature where the scenes are just really long. It's sort of like, okay, we get these long looks and these long, you know, pondering sort of reflective moments, and it felt like they didn't quite find enough meat on the bones to justify a feature. But that said, they are very talented, and it has a lot of good stuff going for it.
Yeah, Alex Pettifer had been in some YA movies.
Yeah,
he's a British actor. He'd been like a kind of generic pretty boy in various YA young adult movies, and he gets to be darker and grittier here, and he's better than I would have expected. There's a depth to him that I did not expect.
The Strange Ones, the film, the dramatic thriller, is rated R. Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Pettifer was also in Magic Mike. He was in the cast.
There you go.
That
You've
film.
Seen a lot of him then.
All right. Next up is Egypt's submission for Best Foreign Language Oscar. The movie is Sheikh Jackson. It's directed by Amir Salama, who co-wrote the screenplay with Omar Khaled. Wade?
Now, there's something really weird this week. We have two foreign language films that both recreate the dance sequence in the Thriller video, neither of which actually licensed the music, so they do it without the actual Thriller music. This is one of them. It's just it's so odd that you know, it just shows you how long and how far that the influence of Michael Jackson continues to go. This is an interesting, not entirely successful film, but it you know, Egypt has kind of a very spotty history as far as its film industry. It's gone in fits and starts depending on how the politics there go, and it hasn't really existed in any substantial form internationally for a while. So this is, I think, a good step. It's a little bit overly artsy. It's the story of a guy who, as a teenager, was obsessed with Michael Jackson, had his hair like Michael Jackson, watched the videos, learned to dance like him, and goes through some very difficult life steps and winds up being a Muslim cleric later in life, and has apparently left his old life behind until Michael Jackson dies. And then he undergoes this kind of existential crisis. And the film flashes back and forth. It goes from the present day to 1991 when he was younger and having his Michael Jackson phase, and how this affects him. And he's trying to find himself. And it's sort of like it's resurrected all of these old feelings and insecurities and all the things that he thought he had left behind when he had embraced his faith. And that's a very interesting subject. I don't think the film quite lives up to those ambitions.
It's a great premise.
It's a great premise, and it's shot very nicely, and it's really well acted. It sometimes loses its way emotionally. I thought sometimes it wasn't quite sure where it wanted to push the character, and it seemed to be treading water a little bit. But still, I respect the effort.
Sheikh Jackson, Christy.
Yeah. So one thing that it depicts quite in a lovely way is the transformative power of a great song. And Michael Jackson really opens his eyes to this whole world that he did not know was out there. His father is very conservative and very strict and has very traditional ideas about masculinity. And Michael Jackson upends all that for this kid. And
calls him a transvestite.
Right, yeah. And he has to, over and over again, assert his independence in, you know, liking what he wants to like and being moved by what he wants to be moved by. And that is a through line to me, is quite compelling. But yeah, it never quite clicks. It kind of loses its way. There's a whole segment where he reconnects with a young lady that he was great friends with as a youth, and that part felt kind of half-baked to me.
What I appreciated most is sort of where it winds up going, and this isn't giving anything away, but the idea that, and this is perhaps something that we don't fully grasp here, but there is an ongoing debate in the Islamic world as to how you reconcile a very old and very conservative faith with all of the trappings of westernized modernity that are invading these cultures. And in this film, in a very Egyptian way, and Egypt is one of the sort of more forward-thinking societies in this regard, at least the faction of Egypt, what this film says is you can reconcile those things. You can be a good Muslim and you can still watch and dance, you know, to Michael Jackson videos, and that's okay. And that those can be part of the same reality and the part of the same world for you, and you're not betraying one for the other. And that's a difficult thing for a lot of the Islamic world to sort of grasp at this point. And this film seems to be saying that. I don't think it's a little bit of an awkward zigzag to get there, but it eventually gets there, and I think it's a good message.
But the women in it are very strong. There's a therapist he goes to see who is very independent. Mm-hmm. There's a musician he connects with who is her own woman. So, and even his own wife, you know, she thinks for herself, which I appreciate.
Oh, she's great.
The strong women in this, I think, are.
When he says it's okay to do that again, she says, "I already did it. You know, I wasn't going to wait for you." It was great.
Sheikh Jackson, the film, it's Egypt's official submission for Best Foreign Language Oscar, directed by and co-written by Amir Salama. It's unrated. It's at Lemley's Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. Let's at least get started on Gold Buster, which is a Chinese comedy. Sandra Ng and Yen Pieng Yu star in the film, directed by Sandra Ng in her feature film directorial debut. Wade?
This movie is just bonkers. And it's supposed to be bonkers, but a little bit of background, because if you're not a longtime fan of Hong Kong cinema, you're going to miss a whole lot of stuff. Sandra Ng has been around for over 30 years. She's an established figure for anyone who's a fan of Hong Kong cinema. Her best stuff is just outrageously weird comedy, and she's done a number of films with Stephen Chow in the past, whose work this emulates a little bit. If you're watching this and you think, well, it feels a little bit like, you know, Shaolin Soccer and the Stephen Chow films of late, yes, it absolutely does, and it's intentional. But this is her first time that she's gone to actually direct and produce and star in, and it's pretty fun.
What did you think, Christy?
It's nutty, but in a great way. It's got a wonderful energy about it. The camera work, the way it's edited, it is nonstop. It's never boring. It's very lively. It's too broad. Yeah, for sure. The characters are all wacky, broad types, but a lot of inspired visuals and a lot of camera angles and slapsticky stuff that's really well thought out and well crafted.
Gold Buster is the film, directed by and starring Sandra Ng, co-starring Yengping Yu. The movie is unrated. You can see it at the AMC Orange, the AMC Puente Hills, and AMC's Atlantic Times Square in Alhambra, or Monterey Park, I should say. The movie is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear about the sci-fi thriller Devil's Gate. We'll also talk about some of the bigger movies that got limited releases in late 2017 that are now going wider. Film Week with our critics back in 1 minute. This is Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Two chances to hear us on 89.3 KPCC every Friday at 11 o'clock, Saturday at noon here on KPCC. But if you miss the broadcast of it, it's always available wherever you get your podcasts. And we invite you to leave a comment about the program as well. Always helpful to share what you like about Film Week so that others can be directed to the program as well. We continue with our critics this week, Wade Major and Christy Lemire. And just to finish off with Gold Buster, Hong Kong actress Sandra Ng makes her directorial feature film debut here and stars in it. Christy, briefly, what's the plot of Gold Buster?
So there is, if I can even begin to try to describe this, there is a dilapidated old apartment building in the middle of a sprawling city that's being developed all around it. It's like a little island of darkness and dilapidation in the middle of it all. And the owner of the building wants to scare all of the remaining tenants out of there and has hired a couple of guys to dress up like ghosts to freak them all out and get them to leave, but nobody will leave. And then they hire a woman, kind of like in Insidious, they hire a woman who supposedly is a medium.
Played by Sandra Ng.
Yeah. To purge the building of spirits. And that is basically just the setup for the wackiness.
It's a lot of slapstick, and it's worth noting, if you know the history of Hong Kong comedy and especially ghost movies, there are tons of inside jokes here. There's a hopping vampire gag, which will make no sense to anyone unless you've seen any of the hopping vampire movies of the 80s and 90s, which is a thing. They even wear the same costumes. It's absolutely ridiculous. But all those inside jokes are fun. Chinese Ghost Story gets a couple of nods, so that stuff is fun. I would also point out, Sandra Ng it's not her voice that you hear. She doesn't speak Mandarin. She speaks Cantonese. She does all of her lines in Cantonese, and I think a couple of the other actors who are Hong Kong actors as well. So they are dubbed into Mandarin. So it's a little bit like an Italian movie
from the
1960s.
And then you watch it subtitled.
You watch it subtitled. Most Americans will not even notice because you're not watching the lips. But if you are a Mandarin speaker or a Cantonese speaker, you will notice that immediately.
But you also are subtitled in Cantonese and English.
Yes.
And it's also your second movie of the week that has the thriller dance sequence.
That's the one.
Goldbuster is unrated. Devil's Gate, a sci-fi thriller directed and co-written by Clay Staub. Peter Aperlo is the co-screenwriter. Amanda Schull stars in the film. Wade, what'd you think of Devil's Gate?
Boy, you know, it's funny. There are these horror films that always seem to come out early in the year where you watch them and you think, you know, genre films, horror, sci-fi, fusion, combo films, and you think, this is an incredibly really competent film, good special effects and some good production value in the service of just the dumbest story ever. And I wish these people would put more effort into the scripts and the ideas here, because it's a waste of production value. It's a waste of everybody's time and energy to do this. The idea basically here is that out in the middle of North Dakota, there's a missing person situation. So an FBI agent and a local deputy go to investigate at the father's home. And, of course, the home is all boarded up, and there's all kinds. He's got something locked up in the basement, which turns out to be, of course, a creature that doesn't give anything away. If you haven't figured that out by the first 30 seconds, you've never seen a movie in your life. And somehow this is all wrapped up in the disappearance of his wife and child. And eventually this thing just blows up into the most absurdly ridiculous sci-fi horror concept ever. I don't know what they were thinking. I don't know why they thought this would be a good subject for a movie. But they got it funded. And they got it made. It's really unfortunate to watch it, to see this much money and this much production value in the service of something that just winds up being so dumb.
Devil's Gate at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood and the Frida Cinema Santa Ana. It's unrated. Stratton, an action film starring Dominic Cooper, is directed by Simon West. It's written by Warren Davis II and Duncan Falconer, based on Falconer's book. Christy?
This is an incredibly generic action movie that hits every single beat and features every single plot line and every single character that you come to expect, to such an extent that it almost plays like a parody. Having said that, it has no energy to it. So clearly they mean it and they're serious. It's not meant to be a comedy. There's no winking and like, haha, you've seen this before. Dominic Cooper, who is a pretty interesting actor and always has an element of danger to his very presence, or something in his eyes that just lets you know he's not a good guy, but he's an interesting physical presence, plays the most sullen and just dour and boring MI6 agent ever. In the beginning of this movie, this mission goes wrong, horribly wrong, as they are wont to do, and he loses his American partner. That's not a spoiler. It happens in the very beginning. But along the way, beyond losing the partner, they lose the thing they were after, the MacGuffin, the chemical agent that they were after. He gets a new American partner, and they got to go on pursuit of the stuff that might blow up somewhere in a major city. It's just, it's a drag. I'm making it sound way more fun than it actually is.
Really?
Simon West, who directed it, is like longtime workmanlike action director, did The General's Daughter, did the first Tomb Raider.
Con Air.
He did a couple of Jason Statham movies, including The Mechanic remake. Yeah. So it's like workmanlike, and just there's nothing special about it.
Part of the problem is that Dominic Cooper, who I like a lot, I really think the world of Dominic Cooper as an actor, but he's not an action star. He just doesn't, he's not a guy that you use to anchor this. He's he's a good, solid British, you know, second lead or a good dramatic actor. Put him in a Shakespearean something. But he just there's nothing about him that makes me think this is the guy that I really want to peg the fate of the world on. This is the guy who's going to he's going to stop the evil Thomas Kretschmann Russian spy from, you know, sending biological agents all over. He's just not that guy. And it never even the opening sequence in Iran where they have to go and find this biological agent. But God, Kretschmann's beaten them to it, and he's taken away, like, by seconds. It makes no sense. They're doing it in broad daylight. There's all this stuff where they have to frogmen their way through this. It's all sort of fabricated action sequences. And the reason it's tedious and boring is because there's never anything at stake that you actually believe in.
The movie is Stratton at Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. It's rated R. Surge of Power, Revenge of the Sequel, an action comedy directed by Antonio Lexerat and Vincent J. Roth. Roth, the stars in the film with John T. Venturini. Wade?
Great merciful Lord in heaven. This is the hazard pay part of the job. So I spent more time researching this than watching the movie, and I don't know why I did that. Apparently, in 2004, there was the first Surge of Power movie, and this guy Vincent J. Roth, who has no excuse for being as terrible a filmmaker and an actor as he is, he's a corporate attorney who somehow pulls the money together and is able to make these really terrible amateurish movies on his own. And they are terrible. The first one, the only unique aspect of it is it was this underground movie about the first quote-unquote gay superhero. Now, I barely call this a movie, and so I don't know if we can actually, you know, compare this to, say, you know, Avengers or Power Rangers or whatever. It lives in its own very fringy world. So it took him until this year, last year, to do a sequel, which during the intervening decade and a half, he's learned nothing. Nothing. You can watch YouTube videos by 10-year-olds that are more competent than this. It's all really, really weird, bad comedy. And somehow he gets name stars to make cameos in these things.
Nichelle Nichols of Star Trek.
Nichelle Nichols is in this. Eric Roberts is in this. Reb Brown, who means nothing to anybody anymore, but Reb Brown, who played Captain America in a TV movie, you know, 25, 30 years ago, is in this, making all these weird, obscure Captain America references that no one is going to get. Now, if you're a real nerd, Reb Brown is the Hunter from the Future, which is also on Blu-ray this week, by the way. But, you know, so it's all this. And then he goes to Comic-Con and he like hijacks people at Comic-Con for these little stand-up interviews that he cuts into the movie and the credits. It's insufferably bad. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
See, I'm just baffled by it because I don't know whether it's meant to be bad. I mean,
it is.
I don't know. Is
like
it?
When he looks in the camera and goes, everyone's a critic.
Yeah.
That's not funny.
Nothing about it is funny. It's totally incompetent from a technical perspective. Like, there's one scene where he goes on a sushi date with this guy that he met in Las Vegas. And you can see and hear the bad looping. Because when the one character speaks, you can hear ambient sound of stuff going on behind them in the sushi restaurant. And then when Serge speaks, it's like silent. And it sounds like this. Like, it's a totally different voice.
So you think that may be intentional?
No, I don't think that was intentional.
There's no technical competence here. There are even large segments where they'll shoot one thing on video, they shoot something else, and it might be an iPhone. It's not timed. It's not color corrected. It's almost as though they just didn't care.
Now he does have an AI car, right? The Surge Mobile.
Well,
why do you know that?
One of our producers, Mary, told me about that.
Research.
Mary, did you actually see the film? She has little bubbles over her head, yes.
Oh, my God.
It has all kinds of really bad digital effects, too. The stuff you do, you know, on your laptop with After Effects now, which appears to have cost them more money than the actual movie.
And also, you have one scene, one exact scene with Linda Blair and Gil Gerard as his parents,
the villain's parents.
Yes,
yeah.
and they're acting. Like, you can tell that they are trying.
Well, they're really giving it their all.
But the lighting is so flat and it looks so horrid, it's hilarious.
You made this sound so interesting. Mary's now online looking at the trailer. She's totally in. Look what you've done.
Here you go, though. 20-year-old Quinn Shepherd made a movie that was, like, light years more entertaining, more on target.
But this isn't even the first time. He did this already in 2004.
Surge of Power, Revenge of the Sequel, rated PG-13 at Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. I do want to mention that there are three films going into general release this week that we've already reviewed on Film Week because they came out in limited release for Oscar qualification before year's end. But they're three that our critics are high on, beginning with Molly's Game, starring Jessica Chastain, Aaron Sorkin, the writer-director of the R-rated film. Christy, quick word on Molly's Game.
So Jessica Chastain stars as Molly Bloom, who in real life set up these underground poker games for the rich and famous and powerful, and she made millions. And then she got dragged down for doing it. It is, if you like Aaron Sorkin, it's super
Sorkin-y. Very Sorkin-esque.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love this movie. It's one of my favorite films of the year. It's a top 10 for me. I think she's great. I think Sorkin's directing is just perfect, and it is a typically great script.
Molly's Game is in wide release now. Now, your favorite film of the year, the Western Hostels.
I love Hostels, and I was even joking before the show, but I mean this. Long, self-important, ponderous, and brutal Westerns always go over big with me, and this is one of them. I think it's a powerful film. It's got a lot on its mind. I love the brooding, seething performances in it, especially from Christian Bale, who I don't think has been this good since
West
he played
Studi's
Batman.
In it. That speaks West well for it.
West Studi is always tremendous. I give a big shout out to Byron Allen's Entertainment Studios, which nearly acquired Birth of a Nation last year. They got this one this year. They are coming in big as a new distributor.
Scott Cooper is the writer director of Hostels. Christy, what do you think of it?
Beautifully shot, but all the things you like about it are the things that I did not like about it. It's ponderous on the ponderosa, that is for sure. It's so long. It takes itself so seriously. How do you understand what Christian Bale is saying?
Hostels is rated R in wide release. And finally, I, Tonya. Margot Robbie plays Tonya Harding, the competitive ice skater. Allison Janney, an incredible performance as her mom. Craig Gillespie directed Stephen Rogers, the screenplay. Wade, quick, I, Tonya.
Just a brutal, hysterical, cutting, satirical slice of madness. I just loved everything about this movie.
It is Goodfellas on ice.
All right. And the supporting roles in it.
Sebastian Stan's great. Allison Janney's great. Margot Robbie learned how to skate right here in Pickwick Ice in Burbank. She's great in it. Oscars
and
all
she
around.
She did a great job on ice,
too. Yeah. It's sad and funny and true or not true, but great.
I, Tonya's rated R. It, too, is now in wide release. Much more to come with Christy and Wade, your favorite high school films. We'll be back right after this update.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures presenting The Shape of Water, nominated for 7 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Director Guillermo del Toro, Best Actress Sally Hawkins, Best Supporting Actor Richard Jenkins, Best Supporting Actress Octavia Spencer, and Best Picture of the Year. Also nominated for a record 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Best Picture of the Year, The Shape of Water. Awards eligible in all categories.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us with our critics Wade Major and Christy Lemire. This week, the Criterion Collection, which is known for its reissues of films with high-quality Blu-ray, has put out John Hughes' The Breakfast Club, a film that for three decades has been a favorite of moviegoers. Some consider it the best film set in high school ever. That may well depend on the era in which you went to high school. For example, if you were a baby boomer, you go back perhaps to Rebel Without a Cause and this famous scene from that 1955 movie starring James Dean.
I try to get to him. What happens? Don't I buy everything you want? A bicycle? You get a bicycle. A car?
You buy me many things.
No, no, no. Well, not just buy. We give you love and affection, don't we? Well, then what is it? Was it because we went to that party? Well, you know what kind of drunken brawls those kind of parties turn into. It's not a place for kids.
A minute ago, you said you didn't care if he drinks.
He said a little drink.
You're tearing me apart!
What?
You say one thing, he says another, and everybody changes back again!
Great performance by Jim Backus in that movie, by the way, as the father of James Dean. Our critics are going to talk with us about their favorite high school set films, but I'd like to hear about yours. There are so many to choose from. Which really connected with you as a send-up of high school or an accurate recreation or connected because one or more of the characters were so familiar to you? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5777. This is for those of you listening to the Friday live 11 o'clock hour of Film Week. You can call in with your favorite high school themed film. But if you're listening to us anytime, you can visit our Film Week page under Air Talk and you can contribute your favorite high school set film of all time. Christy, which one for you stands apart?
Well, The Breakfast Club is very, very important to me. It was absolutely my sweet spot, youth-wise, movie-going-wise. I was about 13 when it came out, and I love all John Hughes movies and can pretty much recite verbatim 16 Candles and The Breakfast Club still. But it felt like The Breakfast Club spoke to me, as I think it speaks to so many teenagers, even though nobody actually talks like this, and the types are absolute types. And I was not the princess, and I was not the basket case, but I felt like there is a connection that everybody has watching it that, okay, we're all misunderstood, and we all feel kind of like outcasts, and we're all going through this angst. And John Hughes wrote in a way that really spoke to teenagers. He was in about his 30s, I want to say, when he wrote Breakfast Club, but he seemed to really get into the mind of what we're all going through.
Well, let's hear from The Breakfast Club, the 1985 John Hughes film, five different high school students brought together by Saturday detention. Here they talk about their newfound friendship.
So on Monday, what happens?
Are we still friends, you mean? For friends now, that is?
Yeah.
Do you want the truth?
Yeah, I want the truth.
I don't think so.
With all of us or just John?
With all of you.
That's a real nice attitude, Claire.
Oh, be honest, Andy. If Brian came walking up to you in the hall on Monday, what would you do? I mean, picture this. You're there with all the sports. I know exactly what you'd do. You'd say hi to him, and when he left, you'd cut him all up so your friends wouldn't think that you really liked him.
No way.
Another thing, when you look at these films, Wade, you think about all these young actors, the so-called Brat Pack of of the era, you know, so many of whom went on to do other stuff as they aged.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, the genius of making any movie is as much in the casting as it is in the actual crafting of the film and just picking the right people. And John Hughes had an amazing knack, not just for writing in a way that reflected how kids talked amongst themselves and thought, which other filmmakers have always tried to capture but never quite gotten there. He nailed it. But he had an eye for talent, and he just picked all the right people. And they were people that had been around a little bit. Molly Ringwald was not unknown, but he gave them the roles that they were able to exploit to the best of their abilities.
Let's take a listener call. Robin in Simi Valley, your favorite high school set film?
My favorite was Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I love that movie, and it had a lot of social groups. You had the stoners and the surfers, which was very similar. I graduated in 83 from high school, so that one really connected with me also. It had some future stars. You had Sean Penn, and you had Judge Reinhold, and so it was like going to my own high school.
And wonderfully written. It was adapted from a magazine article, as I recall.
It was. That one's a little bit creepy for me because I went to school with Chris Penn, Sean Penn's younger brother, so I actually knew many of the characters that Spicoli was based on. I actually know the people that he used to sort of build that character. So that's a little bit creepy for me. But you know what? The one for me is Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That's aces. That's the one that I will always remember. That's still my favorite.
Just such a fun film.
It's just joyous. And you always wish you could be that guy who says the absolute right thing at the absolute right time and gets away with everything and is still charming and adorable. And it's great.
And it breaks rules left and right. It just shatters every expectation you have going in.
Andy, in Long Beach, your favorite film set in high school?
My favorite film was To Sir with Love.
Sidney Poitier.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sidney Poitier and Lulu.
Yeah, who performed the title song for the film, which became a big hit.
That's right. It was a powerful film when there wasn't that many people of color yet, especially a role model like Sidney Poitier. I thought it was a fabulous film.
And as I recall, that film was set in a British public school, wasn't it? And Poitier's a teacher who comes in trying to deal with these disrespectful kids without direction in their life.
And there's a really fascinating through line, by the way, as long as we're on the subject, that starts with the Blackboard Jungle with Glenn Ford as the teacher and Sidney Poitier as the student and one of the students. And that's 55. You move from that to Sir with Love, and then you move from that to Cooley High in 1975, Michael Schultz. That's a really interesting cultural trajectory in American cinema.
I'm glad you brought up Cooley High.
Yeah.
Another. Hey, Andy, thank you so much. Glad you brought up To Sir with Love with the great Sidney Poitier. 866-893-KPCC. You can also, on our Film Week page, visiting AirTalk, click on that, our Film Week page. You can also make your pick. Again, this is for the calls. It's for our Friday Live 11 o'clock hour. Kate, in Silver Lake, what's your favorite in this genre?
I'm going to go with Over the Edge, which was Matt Dillon's debut and sort of chronicled what happened with, I guess you'd call it white flight at the time. And you'd have all these teenagers living out in suburbs with nothing to do. Anyway, great, great movie.
All right. Do either one of you remember that? Over the Edge?
Vaguely.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Kate. 866-893-KPECC. Dillon was in The Outsiders, right?
Yes.
Wasn't that?
And My Bodyguard.
And all right. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, our Film Week page, kpecc.org. Rick in Long Beach, your favorite.
Hi. I have three. Hollywood Nights for comedy. But then from sports, you've got All the Right Moves and Vision Quest. From the 80s, Vision Quest, little known, but it's wrestling by nature. Not many good wrestling movies, but it's
not a lot.
Set in that high school as well.
All right, Rick, I appreciate it. Speaking of sports films, if we expand this to documentaries, it's tough to beat Hoop Dreams.
Very much so.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And if you're talking about sports movies in high school, Friday Night Lights is a great adaptation of a great book.
Hoosiers, another one.
I don't know.
Don't like Hoosiers,
do not.
Do you?
It's super corny, and I have a problem with the fact that the music is so anachronistic.
Yeah,
it's like bad synthy score.
The music is terrible, but it's not alone as an 80s film with a bad synth score. 866-893-KPECC. We have Zach in Long Beach. Zach, real quickly, your pick.
Brick by Ryan Johnson.
Brick. All right.
Wow.
Christy.
Brick is excellent.
Yeah.
Brick's a movie that has definitely grown on me as time has gone on, but I love the specificity of the language. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is great in it. It's a great cast. It's its own unique world. The vision is so specific and so precise and really bold. It's like a film noir in a high school. It's great.
All right. We'll continue with Film Week. And what we're asking is your favorite film set in high school. This because Criterion Collection putting out a brand new pristine Blu-ray of John Hughes' The Breakfast Club 32 years after that film's release. We'll be back in 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Christy Lemire and Wade Major. We're talking about film set in high school and your favorite. This isn't a topic that we've done all the years of Film Week, so it's fun to hear your suggestions for some of your favorite. Let's hear a clip from my favorite, this Richard Linklater's 1993 film, Dazed and Confused. It portrays my actual last year of high school, which was 1976. In this scene towards the end of the film, star football player Randall Pink Floyd reminisces on his high school years with a group of his friends as they smoke weed on the football field the summer before senior year.
Yeah, so what? They're all a bunch of assholes. But you gotta think about it. We've had a lot of really good times right here, Pink.
Yeah, I mean, come on, Pink. I can't believe this. You act like you're so oppressed. And you guys are kings of the school. You get away with whatever you want. What are you bitching about?
Well, look, all I'm saying is that if I ever start referring to these as the best years of my life,
remind me to kill myself.
Well, all I'm saying is I just want to look back and say that I did it the best I could while I was stuck in this place. Had as much fun as I could when I was stuck in this place. Played as hard as I could when I was stuck in this place. Dogged as many chicks as I could when I was stuck in this place.
Dazed and Confused from Richard Linklater.
It's a great movie.
It's laconic, but that's part of the effectiveness.
That also reflects a lot of what I remember from high school. And again, that goes to the subject of casting. Matthew McConaughey, that's the movie that broke him through. And you knew he was going to be a star, you know, working for the city, money in my pocket. And you just knew in that moment, this guy is special. You can't take your eyes off him.
Yeah. Ben Affleck is in it. Joy Lauren Adams. It's an incredible cast. Yeah, he had a real eye, and that is such a Richard Linklater movie. In just the way, it's an easy hang. And if you've seen Everybody Wants Some, right now, and if you've seen Everybody Wants Some after that, it's a good follow up to that in terms of we're just going to hang out now in college.
Christy, what are some of your other favorite? Maybe some that are a little under the radar.
Well, one of my favorite movies ever, which happens to be a high school movie, is Rushmore.
Great film.
And you see the early seeds of what will become Wes Anderson's style, the precision, the use of great 60s deep cut music from the Kinks and the Who. It's just Jason Schwartzman is like a fully formed person in this movie and absolutely controls it. And he and Bill Murray have amazing chemistry with each other. So I love Rushmore. It's smart and it's sad and funny. I like ones that are a little weirder and a little darker in their depiction of high school. So like I love Heathers. And Heathers is infinitely quotable. I mean, speaking of a high school movie that has its own language, like Brick, Heathers totally does. I also love Election.
For Heathers, we have Torrance and Los Feliz called. Not Los Feliz and Torrance. Torrance, go right ahead. Yeah, you wanted to quote something from Heathers.
Yes, I love my dead gay son.
I love my dead gay son. Yeah, I mean, talk about dark humor in that film.
It is. And again, great cast, Winona Ryder and Christian Slater. And it's funny and dark and daring. But I also love Election, which happens to be a high school movie, but is also a great political movie. Young Reese Witherspoon, so commanding. Again, Matthew Broderick as the creepy teacher, which we've seen in a lot of high school movies, but it's so sharp in its satire.
So, Torrance, did you have any other lines from Heathers that you just really remember?
What is your damage, Heather? Or corn nuts, plain or BQ? It's just so quotable.
BQ!
Torrance, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Michael also shouting out on our AirTalk Facebook page for Heather's such a cult hit. Also another listener mentioning Stand and Deliver, of course, which brought us Jaime Escalante, the great teacher from East Los Angeles and an inspirational figure to generations of students.
Yeah.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, Film Week page. Bobby Rivers tweets at AirTalk, John Hughes, fine filmmaker, but there were never any black students in his high school teen movies that were set in the Chicago area. Bobby tweets, I prefer Cooley High.
Yeah.
Bobby, by the way, is Verbum Day High, a graduate from here in Watts. 866-893-KPECC. Army, in San Pedro, your favorite.
Hi. I graduated in 2002, and I think the movie that best represents, like, the boringness of high school is Elephant by Gus Van Sant.
Thank you.
And I love that movie. My favorite parts are when you spend like 2 minutes watching the guy shake the film back and forth. And I remember thinking it was so important to put in a movie because like 5 years after me, nobody would ever have to do that again. And then also when he's like walking down the hallway and he opens the door and it's so bright outside and everything goes white. That happened to me like 7 times a day in high school. I'm just so happy.
Army, thanks. Yeah, thanks so much. Elephant by Gus Van Sant. Charlene in Moreno Valley, Splendor in the Grass, Romance and Conflicted Teenagers, so good. The Elia Kazan film, of course. John in Hancock Park, your favorite set in high school.
Mine has to be Superbad. I think just the accurate depiction of how high school boys talk has never been portrayed more accurately. I think it's never endlessly hilarious and I don't know. I think it's an underappreciated classic.
Our Film Week producer, Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, says Superbad's his favorite, says the kind of stuff high school boys think about but don't say out loud.
Yeah, and Michael Cera and Jonah Hill have such great energy together, and Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd are hilarious in it. It's just, it's a really funny, sweet movie.
John, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Aaron, in Temple City, your favorite high school set film.
Yeah, for me, it would have to be Oh, Captain, My Captain, Dead Poets Society.
Yes.
And finding his voice and being able to really break through that and really questioning authority. And it was a movie that was very important to me. I graduated in 1989, so really being connected to legacy and what that means and, you know, having to deal with really finding your voice.
I appreciate it, Aaron. Good call. Thanks so much. I do think when you're in high school does factor into how, you know, particular movies connect with you. Kate in Pomona, your favorite.
That would be Clueless from the 90s. That was definitely my high school experience.
There are so many funny scenes in Clueless. The dialogue is, I think it's terrific, terrific film.
Yeah, iconic in the performances, in the costume choices.
The music.
Yeah, the music. Jen Chaney, with the Washington Post formerly, wrote an entire book about Clueless.
Really? I mean,
yeah, somebody can wear that yellow plaid outfit that Cher wears, and you know immediately who she is and what movie that is.
It's a kinder, gentler Heathers. A little bit.
It is.
A little bit.
We have Daryl in Highland Park, Up the Down Staircase from 1967. That was set, if I recall correctly, in a New York City public high school. Bill in Valley Village says, The Last Picture Show. I grew up in a town very much like that Texas town that was turning into tumbleweeds. The focus on football as the be-all, end-all in high school was so accurate for me, Bill in Valley Village says. Great Peter Bogdanovich film, The Last Picture Show. Zach in the Miracle Mile District says, Teen Wolf with Michael J. Fox. I was super into him being a scrawny dude, unpopular, and then he gets to become the man. He also liked the music from the film. And Sandy's with you, Wade, on Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Sandy in Long Beach says, you live vicariously through all the mischief and fun they had that day. Great characters you can't help but love. Thanks for all your contributions on today's Film Week. For our critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Have a wonderful weekend. Back with you next week on Film Week.